everyone. Welcome back. As you can see, if you're watching us on YouTube, I hope you're watching us on YouTube. We're new to this whole YouTube thing, right? But we're kind of going. We have a very special guest with us, a face you may or may not recognize. But he needs no introduction. He just top-8ed the biggest regional of all time. Joining us today is Dan Hugart. Dan, would you like to give a little bit of an intro on yourself, where you're from, what you do, whatever, anything you want to say about yourself?
Sure. Thank you for having me on here, man. Really appreciate it. Hi, I'm Dan. I was a former medical device engineer. Now I'm a therapist, so I talk to people about their feelings all the time. I've been playing Pokemon competitively now for like 5 years, and at some point along the timeline, I learned how to play it well. So I had some history, got global top 16 in 2 of the Players' Cups back in the day, and then actually haven't missed a day 2 this season.
Wow.
So we're doing pretty well so far.
Beast.
That is a beast.
Sick. When we miss day 2s, we're going to come to you to talk about it.
please do. Yeah.
The Poke Therapist. I'm
fun employed for a couple weeks while I find another therapy job, so anyone wants to come by, please. My rates are great.
There you go.
I believe it.
Reach out.
I believe it. Thanks for coming on, bro. So just to give a bit of a background on like Dan and I, we met at Worlds in 2022, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. We met at Worlds in 2022. We've played a couple times since. We always bounce lists off each other, whatever. But going into this, I didn't know, A, that you were going, and B, that you were playing our beloved Giratina V-Star. So fantastic surprise, to be honest. Like, because I was following you on PokéStats, and it had, like, the question mark. So I was like, what is this guy playing? He's, like, 8-0-1. This guy's a beast. What is he playing? It can't be Tina. We've been crapping on Tina for months. It can't be Tina. It ended up being Tina. Yeah. He's just better, guys. He's just better. So to start, take us through your San Antonio experience. Maybe not like round by round, but like overall, did you enjoy the event? I hope you did, given that you did so well. But how was the event ran? Both Kieran and I both didn't go, so I'm curious to hear how the event was in general, given that it was the largest like regionals ever.
Yeah, so Jimmy Ballard, the day 2 events guy, every event he runs is awesome, and this was kind of the same. We had essentially 10 rounds because of our lunch break for the stream, and we were done in about 11 hours. Like, that is absolutely wild. Maybe 12 hours, mm-hmm. whatever. Like, it was really well run. Like, everything was smooth. Everyone was super nice, super friendly, super helpful. I got a no-show round 1. My opponent actually showed up in round 2 and played a couple games. So, shout out for you sticking through it, my guy. But otherwise, my deck functioned really well some rounds. And then other rounds, Anil, we hate on Tina for that reason. It just took a giant poop. But the other reason why I love the deck is because unless you just brick and can't play the game, you can usually make something happen. So day 1, that's exactly what happened, is I probably got to effectively play the game 2/3 of the time and won almost all of those games. Then the other 1/3 of the time, I won probably 60 or 70% of those games. So my run went pretty well. I misplayed my way out of 2 wins twice day 1, but luckily didn't burn me. I was able to either steal the round or at least get a tie out of it against Isaiah Bradner. And then, yeah, it was a fun day. And I was real tired at the end of it. So I was like, you know what? We already peaked. We're 8-0-1. This is a great day. I'm going to get a bunch of points. Like, sick. We're going to be good going into day 2.
Nice. Actually, Dan, why don't we start, before we even go into your tournament run, like, how did you end up on Giratina? So I took a peek at your Limitless page before recording. So it seems like this is your 4th regional playing Tina. So maybe walk me through why you've been playing Tina, and maybe why you thought it was good for this event.
I don't know, man. I even said this on my stream interview. I don't know if I want to play Tina. I keep trying to find justifications to not. But my kind of bias coming into any event is I don't want to take auto losses. Mm. Like, you're going to lose to something, but I always want to play a deck that gives me a chance to win in any scenario, since the thing I've learned over the past couple years is I'm a good enough player where if you let me play the game, I have a very good chance of making something good happen. So if I walk into any kind of round with at least a 50-50, I can feel pretty good. I can do my best with it. So Tina is that deck right now where there's one or two matchups that feel horrible, like Sablezard, but you can win any and every game against anything. So for me, just kind of banked on, let's play the thing that'll let me do the thing. I would have loved to play something different, but I've been playing Mariodon for best of 1 tournaments because I have three regional finishes and an IC finish, but I only have 2 cup finishes. I'm horrible at best of one, and Tina is not a best of one. So
I feel
just kind of coming in. Yeah. Yeah. So kind of coming into here, wanted to play the deck, give me a chance in everything, and I know it so well at this point that nothing else would have put me in a better spot to succeed.
Yeah, and honestly, before coming on, I wish I had told you to bring your Tina V-Stars. I want to see the shuffle creases on the back of those babies, because I know, man, you've been using those things, man. Like, I thought I played Tina a lot, and then I met you, and I was like, holy, you like your Tina. And I think, more like, and this speaks to this more than anything, I think this is such a good testament to not, like, one-tricking per se, but playing what you're best with. Like,
yeah,
you can play a deck that you're best with, and, like, we've had this conversation so many times where it's like, Tina is so mid. It feels so mid a lot of the time, right? But yeah, you're so good with it that it legit doesn't matter. And like you said, like, you get in these situations sometimes where you're like, okay, my hand is six switching cards and a Tina. What do I do? Eventually, you draw an energy and you Abyss Seek and you can kind of get out of it. So Tina, to your point,
really
is that deck. Like, you can get yourself out of these bad situations. It's not like Gardevoir, where if you open, like, Zacian Pass, you just lose, right? You always have some sort of out. And I think, I don't know, obviously you were at the event, so I'm sure you didn't watch stream too much, but the Tina games that were on stream, I think about 50% of the games were legit just like attach Abyss Seeking Prey. So the deck got a great, it's very well shown on stream how it actually runs. Speaking of which, tell us about your list a little bit. What did you like? What did you not like? Any like cool inclusions that you wanted to point out?
Yeah, so I basically took my LAIC list and changed two cards. One, I moved a switch back to a switch cart, just with Sablezard being a bit bigger, Rapid Strike being a big play, being able to have the extra healing out was probably better than being able to move a V-Star. And then the other piece was I took out Manaphy, which I got burned by this a lot in Peoria earlier this year because I played seven or eight Lost Zone decks. But the only decks that really spread are Rapid Strike, which you don't want to bench Manaphy anyway because it's a lie and it's a Yoga Loop target, and then some Lost Zone decks or Greninja. And just, that's not enough of a meta. So I think it's really important in Tina to play six. I get to play the game cards. So four Colorus, obviously, I have the one Pokégear in there to let me kind of play the game on top of Flower Selectings. And then if I had another slot, I really wanted it to be something that lets me play the game. So chose Avery because testing into the event, going against Zard, especially the Bivoral Zard, if they bench like Manaphy, Jirachi, things get super sketchy. So being able to kind of like erase that and force them to make hard choices was the idea. It was not a good idea. Don't recommend it. It was basically just a draw three in the best case scenario. And there were a couple games where they had like liabilities on the bench or damage stuff, or I was trying to set up Sableye turns where I used it to draw cards, it would actually like remove a win condition or decrease my ability to make something happen. So I think I need to swap that out for a different play the game card. I'm not sure what that'll be, but otherwise, this is good, man. Bradner had two boss, one countercatcher, which I'm not offended by, but having a couple countercatcher I think is valuable. And otherwise, it's 3-3 Tina, 4 Comfy, just do your thing.
Yeah, I think
so. Sorry, go ahead. I just have one question for the list before we move on.
I was just going to say, I think the double countercatcher makes sense. If you play Avery, was it kind of your logic, like, I can Avery and then countercatcher something else? Or, like, was that some of the thought that went into it? Or no, it was just, like, you just prefer the countercatcher overall?
No, so I think that is a good, like, combination. And we did stuff like that with even, like, Rope and Avery a couple formats ago. Really, it's in there for the Roxanne path countercatcher. Because if you're able to either eliminate their threat or stall something up to then Sableye spread with the Roxanne path, you can buy yourself a couple turns to get back into the game. But honestly, countercatcher is really good if you feed someone a Comfy, or say you have to Abyss Seeking twice, like I did many, many times, and they knock out your Tina, you're then able to still Colrus or Roxanne and take out a threat, and then still take out a threat with a Roxanne or something the next turn. So just being able to still play the game and guts up the threat is a huge, huge deal because you're almost always behind.
Makes sense. Yeah. So the one question I had for you as well, and this is coming from a place where I have also played a very bad count of VIP pass to a major tournament. And so I need to inquire just for scientific reasons. Why 3 VIP and 4 NESBall? Is there like a reason behind it, or was it just like, YOLO, let's do it?
Well, number one, I hate Battle VIP Pass with a fiery passion. I can't wait till it rotates. But there's actual reason for this one. So this was prepping in for LAIC because I played three VIP, four nest and LAIC. Kevin Krieger and I had talked through it. And with Tina, like we're talking about, you almost always fall behind. Like you, it's not like Turbo Lawson Box where you fill your board and just do everything. It's really important to find the right attackers at the right time throughout the game, whether it be Cram, Sableye, whatever. And because you have evolutions, you need to get your Tinas down usually ahead of time or in advance. So you have to bench stuff in a very specific order. So a lot of times you brick turn one with Tina. So the VIP really has less value overall. So for us, it was still seven ball search cards, like still seven get guys out on the board. But it made sense to have more nest balls left over for later in the game when you need to go rot in that Sableye and go find it than it is to be able to get two Tina V down turn one.
Okay. Yeah, and I agree with that as well. Like, I think the hardest part with Tina, for me at least, was streaming Sableye. And, like, you get in positions in games where you're like, okay, if I can stream Sableye, I just win this game. But you get stuck because your deck just kind of does whatever your deck wants sometimes, and you don't have exactly what you want. So I do support the four nest ball thing. I just wanted to inquire for the audience and for scientific research.
Yeah.
Because we might be onto something here.
And then one more question I had here. So I saw you played the Spirit Tomb, so obviously respecting the Mew. So was that maybe like the Manaphy slot, it turned into a Spirit Tomb? And was it just for Mew, or were there any other matchups you were looking out for?
Actually, Manaphy became Avery. Because we had six of the play the game slots in LAIC, and people convinced me to put Spirit Tomb in instead of one of those, which played a Mew round one at LAIC. Thanks, everybody. It was good against Mew, and I actually managed to tie a Fusion Mew when my deck did nothing for three turns, two games in a row.
Okay.
And partially because of Spirit Tomb. But it's also really good into Block Lax, because you turn off Pidgeot V's ability, you turn off Rotom, and it's good into Charizard for the same reason. So went first against Charizard at least one round, put down a path, put down a Spirit Tomb, and their deck just refused to function because they had no way to actually like draw cards to get what they needed. That being said, I don't know if it's worth a slot, but I think Mew's getting more and more hype, even with as much Zard as there is. So probably worth including since it does have value across a bunch of matchups.
Cool. Yeah, and actually one other question I wanted to ask you about, maybe not specifically the list, but like, do you choose to go like first or second? Like, I know it might be matchup dependent, but like, let's say it's like blind. Would you choose first or second?
Honestly, I kind of hoped my opponents won the course with every round. I had no idea in some of these matchups. I think in general, I think blind, I chose to go second only because like Abyss Seeking turn one is fine.
Yeah.
So it's not bad. And Zard wants to go second. Block Lack wants to go second. Maridon wants to go. Maridon kind of wants to go second. Yeah. So in general, I think it makes sense against Maridon, against Gardy, against really anything where a turn one path can absolutely mess them up. I think you want to go first because you want to be able to get that turn one path down. As on my stream game, I got turn one path down twice, and it was the only reason I won game two is because of that. So I think blind second, if you know the matchup and path is hugely problematic, I would go first.
Okay, that makes sense to me. And I guess one other question I have for you is like, what matchups are you looking to Abyss Seeking turn one? Is it like just a bailout, or are there something? None?
None. Honestly, Zard probably, but if I would so much rather either Cram hit or end on something more interesting, but being able to Abyssy to set up for like a turn two lost impact, or if you know they can't really do much, then that's fine.
Okay,
cool. Yeah, I kind of played the Tina the same way. Like, I hated Abyss Seeking, so I kind of get it. I just don't know, like, the way new Tina kind of works, and I say new Tina because I haven't played in a bit, but that's why I'm so intrigued by your run and how it went. I see players Abyss Seeking a lot more, especially more than they used to, because I guess the format slowed down a little bit. How do you feel about like the Lost Box mirror now? How has that kind of changed? I know Lost Box itself isn't as big as it was, but do you feel favored? Yeah. Do you feel unfavored? Because I know that like that pendulum switched a little bit towards the end, because in the beginning it was very Lost Box favored. And then towards the end, people started learning how to play the matchup and it started to feel Tina favored. So like, where is it at now?
That's a great question. So I was actually, Robin Schultz was posting about this on Twitter, about there's just 14 billion versions of Lost Box right now. So it's hard to even like describe what they all are. I think into Sablezard, like into things that focus on like super quick Sableye spread, you're definitely unfavored because you can't really keep pace with that. What you do have though going for you is the Roxanne path. And I think the path is a really big deal against Sablezard, because if you can stick path, Zard's ability doesn't turn off and they can't one shot you. So I think I would say it's favored into anything that can't handle a V-Star Roxanne path, because it then buys you enough turns to kind of get back into the game. Other stuff that can, like, out-turbo you, like, you can still lose to it. It's really just if they're able to map out their prizes quicker than you can set up a board that negates that. So as far as Abyss Seeking goes, I don't think I try to play into Abyss Seeking. Like, I don't try to go second so I can Abyss Seeking into anything except for Block Lacks. But it often becomes the best play just because then you're ready to either Mirage Gate, Lost Impact, like Sableye, turn two, your turn two, whatever it may be. It's more, it's an available option if you're not going to get hard punished for it.
Okay, nice. That makes sense. It's like there's just so many different ways of playing this damn deck that like you keep it keeps evolving over and over and over, and I'm like, oh my god, like I just learned it. Why are we still evolving? So that's interesting.
And that's why I love the deck too, because I don't think there is a set right way to do it most of the time, because like you're talking about, your hands can be wild. Sometimes I'll have two Colress turn one, other times I won't see a Colress until after I play Roxanne. You can win all of those games if you map out things like as precisely as possible. So it's fun to play because no game is the same. That's not always good, but fun.
Yeah.
And that leads me really well into my follow-up question here. So I actually, like, so when you go on a big run, right, there's always one thing you can kind of, that sticks out above the rest that you can kind of attribute to. So for example, like at LAIC, the one thing I could think about was like turn one hands. Is like I was just going at Guardies and killing them with turn one hands. Kieran's deck was like mostly consistency. He set up like almost every single game. That was the kind of thing like he can attribute to a success. Was there one thing that you can attribute to your success? Because like you said, with a deck as variable as Tina, where you don't know what you're drawing, every game is kind of different. Do you think a lot of your wins came down to you just knowing what you were doing, having to play the deck for as long as you did, or did you hit good mashups? Like, was there one thing that really stood out for you, or just a good run in general?
That's a great question, man. I think, and it's kind of a weird answer, because I feel like knowing when to scoop is really valuable in a best of three. I think, honestly, that very rarely did I ever say, I can't do this, like, I can't win. Like, I think I tried very hard to, in every single situation, play optimally and play as if there is a line for me to win the game. Because with Tina, like, there's such comeback potential. There were more than a few games where I was down, actually against Guardi, my round two, I was down 6-2 before I even, like, was able to attack. And I won that game because Roxanne, Path, Countercatcher, Sableye spread, and then they do nothing. Star Requiem, the EX, I had counter captured up, and they just have nothing on their board. And I win the game after getting my butt whooped for the last 25 minutes. So I think that's probably the thing for Tina, and it's a little different than other decks in the format, is if you just play optimally the whole way through, no matter how good or bad things look, you almost always have a shot to win at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, Roxanne Path is just, like, so strong. Like, it's just, like, that's the thing. I can understand why it's hard to scoop. So I guess my other question I was going to ask as a follow-up there is, how many of your rounds went, like, the full three games? Because I feel like Tina and Gardevoir kind of have the same problem, where it's, like, really hard to play a full three games in a set if you don't scoop one of them early.
So I'm not a slow player. Like, I play really fast, even with Tina being a very, like, decision-heavy deck. So I think I had a couple rounds go into game three, where one, I was in a losing position in game three, but it was too early. And a couple, I was in a strongly winning position in game three. It just didn't happen. But a lot of times when I did get into a tie, I lost game one. And so I was trying to kind of claw back in game two. And part of the downside was I had a shot to win game one up until the last turn, and then they would close it out or draw with an 8 off Roxanne. So I totally lost your question. It's a long day. But basically, I think the games, you could finish three games sometimes, but it would require both players playing at a very, like, high, rapid pace.
So then maybe did you have, like, I think you won, like, 11 rounds. Like, were any of those rounds, like, just, like, 1-0 rounds, or were they mainly, like, 2-0 rounds?
No, I finished two games in every round, at least. And then there were a couple rounds I won three. Typically, if I won the round, it was 2-0. I didn't actually lose a game until after lunch. And then I think I lost two lost two more games throughout the rest of the day after that. Like, the deck, it was some combination of me and the deck and my opponent's decks being kind to me that day one went pretty smoothly.
Yeah, I mean, 8-0-1 is, that's very hard to do. Like, I've never done that well in day one of a tournament. So, yeah, obviously, like, you're a great pilot of the deck, and it seemed like it was your day. So that's awesome. Cool. So I kind of want to move on a bit here to the back half of your run here. So you're day two. So when you go into a day two, you're at 25 match points. All right, you know you need, like, 11 to make the cut. What's kind of like going through your head? Like, what is, like, is, are you like, I need to take this one game at a time? Or like, are you like, I need to make top eight? Were you just like happy to get like top 32 or whatever? Like, what was your goals going to day two?
So I'm going to come at this a little sideways. I actually realized that I'm the most successful when I stop caring about the results. But for me, the way I've kind of tried to refocus myself is that, like, listen, we're playing a fun game. We're having colorful monsters punch. Like, this is, I know people are passionate about it and I support it, but it's still like a hobby. It's still something fun. Yep. So my actual goal walking into every tournament, every round, it's literally just like, can I be a good human being and kind and like have it be a good, enjoyable event? And can this be an opportunity to like show what it's like to be a good person playing this game? So obviously want to play hard. So for me, I think coming in, I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to do the best I can. The deck's good. I'm going to try to play smart, but I'm going to try to keep the focus on, am I doing right by like my opponent, what's happening? And then cards will fall where they fall. And for me, it helps take the pressure off. And I just have way more fun.
Yep.
I just want to go play more Pokemon. So I think I tried very hard to go at it as a like one round at a time. Like, doesn't matter what my record is until whether or not I can ID. I just need to go play the best I can, try to get the right result and see what happens.
Yeah, I agree with that mindset 100%. Like, at the end of the day, like, there's chance involved in this game. So, like, even if you play perfect, like, if the cards don't come your way, they don't come your way. So, no, I'm glad to hear, like, you have a great approach to the game. So, I saw here in, I just looked at your PokéStats, you were doing pretty well against Charizard before finally losing in top 8 to Grant. So, maybe can you go over your top 8 match? Like, what happened? Like, why do you think that was your downfall there?
Well, I lost owned 8 energy, both game 1 and game 2. And I used Lost Impact once each game.
Oh, nice.
That'll do it.
So it was brutal. It was, my deck just completely imploded in top 8. At one point, I failed the Poke Gear, and as I was looking at the cards in my hand, that were all energy and stabilize and rods, I'm just like, you know what? I am very grateful to have gotten top 8 at this regional. And Grant just started dying laughing because it just... But even there, even with my deck absolutely collapsing, falling to pieces, game one, I was within a Roxanne path of winning the game. And then game two, very similar thing. Like, it came down kind of to the wire. Just, I couldn't get the last pieces I need. And in top 8, I did not play as optimally as I could have or probably should have. But it was very much the opposite of what I said earlier. Earlier throughout the tournament, I tried to play as optimally as possible, even when I was in a horrible spot, and I was able to pull it out. Here, I didn't play super optimally, and I don't know if it was a difference maker, but it was not close. The deck just refused to function, and it wasn't enough to get by.
Yeah, and to be honest, I like what you said about, like, just, you know, I'm happy to be here. And like, that's such like an important mentality to have. Like, obviously it's really good to shoot. You want to win the tournament, but a lot of players see like incremental success. So like ourselves are great examples of that, right? Like you start with the deck, you start with Tina, you're making day twos and over, and then suddenly you top 8, and the next time maybe you'll top 4, and then you'll win, whatever it is, right? So understanding where you are, being grateful of like where you came and what you accomplished, like, dude, the biggest regional of all time. And you took a deck that plays the game 60% of the time and top 8 with it.
So it's
pretty impressive, bro. And like, speaking to your point earlier, you do a great job of just embodying what it is to be a good Pokemon player. Just to be a nice guy, like, whether you're down, whether you're up, you're playing well, you're talking well. And like, we hit it off right from the beginning when we were playing at Worlds, right? Just because like, it's good to be a nice person. And I think a lot of people kind of get lost on that. And they get really sweaty in sweaty moments, and that's fine. But being a good person will always be valued over other things. And opponents will let you take things back. People will let you, they'll have a little bit more leniency with you when you're just a nice person. So everybody learn from Dan.
Yeah.
Everyone learn from Dan. Well, stop what you're doing and learn from Dan.
100%. Like, my checklist of when someone asks me to take something back, top of the list is, like, were they enjoyable to play against so far?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So, with that, so we've recapped your run pretty well here. I want to talk about your deck a little bit more as well, but let's talk about what happened overall. Like, I'm looking at this Limitless page right now, and it's, like, the most, like, diverse thing I've seen in my life. So... there's a lot going on here. What did you, and Dan, we can start with you. Is there a deck you felt maybe underperformed a little bit? Maybe a deck that overperformed? Were you surprised to see anything in day two that maybe you hit or was around you? Like, what really stood out for you?
This is going to be such an elitist comment, but I didn't go lower than table two during day two. So I didn't actually see very much.
Oh, that's the best.
I went 303 day two, so I just stayed up there. In general... because I was paying a little bit of attention, especially coming out. Guardy didn't do anything in the top, like, 8, 16, which I think is a lie. I think Guardy's better than the results showed in this tournament, because Zard is a very good matchup for Guardy. Rapid Strike is probably not as good in the Guardy as players would like it to be. Like, Guardy's fine into Tina, especially with Jirachi and Manaphy and everything. So I think it'll probably do much better in Portland than it did here. But that was probably the biggest surprise for me. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I think...
same here for me.
I mean, Gardevoir is one of those decks where I'm not surprised when it does really well, and I'm not surprised when it does very poorly. Just because it is a little bit, like, depends who's playing it. So I don't know how many, like, top groups were playing it this weekend. And, like, it's just kind of, like, slow and, like, random. So... that's not that surprising, but maybe then you can talk to maybe the Giratina versus Guardy matchup. Like, how do you feel about that matchup? Because I feel like it's very close, and I feel like the Gardevoir players say, oh, I think the matchup's fine. The Tina players say the matchup's fine. So how do you feel about that matchup?
You're going to time no matter what, by the way.
Yeah, dude, every matchup feels horrible with Tina. There's no time I sit down and I'm like, oh, thank God I'm playing this.
Yeah.
It's so weird because previously, before Countercatcher was a thing, like, you always wanted to take the lead as Tina because you just want to set up that, like, Sableye, like, checkmate scenario. Now, I feel like you don't want to. Like, you want to almost stay behind until you can have a big, sweep Roxanne path turn. And Jirachi makes it so much harder. One of the cards I was considering including in the list was Lost City, purely for that matchup and Jarizard to just Lost Zone some Jirachis, but a little over the top, and path is probably better in general. But I think it's close. And I think it actually depends a lot on draws and a lot on skill of, like, how each player goes about it.
Yeah, I think I would generally agree with that. Like, yeah, like, on the Gardevoir side, too, it's, like, very interesting because, like, when you're behind, it's, like, I get to do the Iono Countercatcher, one of your Giratinas. And, like, you're saying, like, the Tina, if they do Roxanne Path Countercatcher, like, it's actually really hard to draw that as Guardy. So yeah, I think the matchup, like you're saying, is pretty skill-based, and I do enjoy playing it because it feels like every game is, like, different. Like, it doesn't feel like there's a standard, like, prize map or, like, way the game goes. And depending on who's on the losing side, like, it's just, like, so different. So, yeah, definitely a really fun matchup to play. I think one deck maybe that we can talk about that was kind of surprising was there's a Palkia in the top four. So, I mean, that had, like, a showing in one of the European regionals. I can't remember which one. I think the Poland one. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what did you guys think about this? Like, maybe, Neil, you start because we were talking about this before. It was pretty similar to the build that had success in Poland. So, what do you think?
Bro, this thing won't go away. It won't go away, man. Like, I still have PTSD from Worlds, like, in 2022 when it was just littered everywhere. But, honestly, in all seriousness, I'm happy to see, like, these different archetypes do well. So, like, when you look at a Limitless page, it's super diverse, and I think we can all agree that, like, coming out of last year where, like, 70% of Day 2 Limitless pages were Lugia, it's really nice to see all these different decks doing well. But to speak to Palkia itself, I can understand why the deck is good. Like, it makes sense. It's one of those cards, it's kind of like Charizard, where the stats are just kind of good. Where it just has a lot of health, hits really hard, has a lot of options, has Melanie, obviously. You have Star Portal to open up Greninja. You have Ice Rider for Maridon. Like, it feels like you check all the boxes. So seeing it go that far wasn't particularly surprising to me, to be honest with you. I was more surprised about Gardevoir not doing well than by Palkia doing well. I don't know if you had the same kind of idea there, Dan.
No, I would agree. I don't know if I love the Palkia deck in general, just because it's also a 2-2-2, but you have to evolve your guys, and Maridon and others don't. Though I love seeing Ice Rider do well, kind of per your comment. I think maybe, and this is just a guess, Guardy not doing as well probably paved the road for that, because I don't know the matchup, but I got to imagine Palkia has a horrible Guardy.
It's really bad. It's a Torts matchup for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so actually, yeah, I was going to make that comment too when Anil was saying how Guardy went down. It's like you're saying it, like, it literally goes hand in hand. Like, I'm just looking at Joseph's, like, Poke stats. He didn't play against any Gardevoirs. So, makes sense that he had a good weekend. Because, yeah, I think all the other matchups seem, like, winnable. So, cool. And I think the other cool thing that, if we're going to move on with Palkia, is we saw some Turbo Maridon decks. So, like, Anil, they were kind of similar to what you played at LAIC, but now they, like, focus even more on Peony. So, like, Anil, what were your thoughts now on the evolution of your Turbo Hands deck?
Kind of jokes. It's it's funny to see people just want to discard their hand for fun every turn, but, you know, like, in all seriousness, I do understand why it's good. Peonies, honestly, man, like, when I was playing at LAIC, I barely used Peony, to be perfectly honest with you. But, it seems like it's found a home. It seems like four Peony and Mew is strong, and it makes sense. Like, the synergy is pretty good. It just kind of scares me playing 1/1 Flaffy. You prize one of those things and you don't have either. But other than that, yeah, it's nice to see it do well. I'm surprised to not see Maridon Path, like, more so towards the top. I think the two top builds are both, like, turbo, go crazy, 18 energy builds. So it's a little surprised to see that. But like you guys said, like, that's kind of the relationship with Guardy in this whole format, where Guardy's not there, you don't have a whole lot to feast on. So it kind of makes sense they didn't do too well, because that path build and Maridon in general just isn't good into Charizard. And Charizard was littered absolutely everywhere. So, yeah, not totally shocked, but the amount of Charizard definitely surprised me, I think.
And it converted really well, too. Like, I think it went from, like, 17 or something day one to, like, 20-something day two.
Is there a ghost behind you?
No, my chair just fell. My side chair. Yeah,
haunted, man.
Haunted, man. Yeah, cause just looking. Yeah, I was just looking at Nick, like, the Maridon that made top eight. His three losses in the tournament were Charizard. So,
yep,
makes sense to me.
The matchup's awful. Like, it's legitimately awful. So yeah. I don't even know how we got that far. Like, how do you even dodge all the Zards? You're just better.
Well, I mean, if Charizard has, like, a 20% meta share over 15 rounds, that's, like, three, which is actually what he faced. So.
It's fair.
Yeah.
So the one other thing that surprised me, sorry, I just want to bring one more thing up before we move on. And Dan, I don't know if you saw this around you, played against it or anything, because I do not have your Pokestats up, because I'm not a good podcast host, but there was a Lugia up there. There's a Lugia up there at 21st or 22nd or something like
22nd,
that. 22nd,
yeah.
22nd, yeah. What are you, did you see it? Did you, like, interact with it at all?
I know the guy who played it, and he didn't hit a single Maridon. He didn't hit a single Maridon. I don't think he played a Guardy either, or if he did, he probably took the L to it. Like, it just, I don't know how it beats Charizard. I don't know how it beats.
Well, he played Shaymin V.
I mean, that's cool. That is actually really cool.
That's your, like, let him cook moment.
Yeah.
Just let him cook. Let him cook.
Yeah. I mean,
a tournament this big, it's not surprising one snuck in somewhere or something weird did.
Yeah, he faced three Rapid Strike, so that's pretty much an auto win. He faced an Iron Valiant. It looks like that's pretty much an auto win. I feel like the Lost Zone matchup is actually pretty good for Lugia, because you play the hands. So, but yeah, he didn't play much Charizard. He played three. He lost the two. I don't think I see a Gardevoir on this. So, yeah, it's interesting. I don't think this is, like, a tier one or something, like, super serious, but it's kind of cool to see that, like, you can still, like, make it deep with a deck like Lugia.
Yeah, we just spent last week trashing it. So
yeah, we did. Really
glad you know what, man? Like, there's so much, like, meta manipulation in this. I just want everyone to know that everything that happens on this podcast is pure thoughts. We're not meta manipulating. We actually thought Lugia was bad, and we were very, very wrong.
I mean, it still is, like, objectively, like, bad relative to the other decks. But, like, if you dodge and hit, like, good stuff, then you'll do well. And just to, I think the last deck I just want, or there's two more decks maybe. Like, one I want to talk about is, like, the Rapid Strike. So I think going into this tournament, that deck had a lot of hype. It does, in theory, have a very strong matchup spread against, like, the best, like, four or five decks. And we saw one person bubble, another in top 16, another, like, two in top 32. So, what do you guys think about Rapid Strike coming back into the meta? And, like, do you think it's going to be more of a contender going forward? Dan, why don't you could give us your thoughts first.
Yeah. So Sky, who got top 16, actually lost to Nick on the win and into top eight. So, and she, I don't think saw an Urshifu in game three, is really how you win that game. So, I think it's really good. Most of the people in the Airbnb I stayed in played Rapid Strike, and they didn't have as good of a run, just because I think it's such a polarized match. If you hit the good matchup, you're going to have such a good time. But if you don't, like, there's not a lot of ways to play around it. So it's almost a little similar to Lugia, just with maybe a higher overall percentage. If you hit your matchups, you could go so far, and if you don't, you're going to have a hard time.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be dodging the Mew, and then the deck's a little bit inconsistent, so like you have to also be setting up. So yeah, I think it's like a solid deck. Like, I don't know if I'd call it tier one, but it definitely feels like on the cusp of tier one. It just doesn't see that much play for how good the deck is, yeah, in my opinion.
And when you play the game, it is so strong, man. Yeah. It's just like, the problem is you don't play the game all the time, and you don't have like the benefit of being a Giratina or a Maridon where you just like fill your bench or you Abyss Seeking or whatever. Like, there's certain decks that can kind of just get themselves out of bad situations. Rapid Strike is not one of those decks. Like, if you're sitting there like splashing with Remoraid, you're just going to lose. So it's interesting that it got as far as it did. That was actually my pick to win the tournament. I thought Rapid Strike was going to win the tournament because just on paper, like, you look at it, you're like, if you give a good player this deck, they shouldn't lose. And especially into the field that it was, like, I was surprised that Mort didn't go far. Obviously, there's one unfortunate bubble. But like you said, like, the consistency issues really hold it back. And I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't, like, blow up.
Yeah, 100%. And then finally, last deck I want to talk about, speaking of a deck that doesn't see as much play as how good it is the Snorlax. So we saw two actually make top eight, but the deck has actually evolved since the first iteration LAIC. So it's a lot more teched out now. Like, they're playing Pidgeot EX. There's, like, Luxray V in there. I think I saw him a while. So Dan, you were obviously very excited whenever someone flipped over a Snorlax. That's a good matchup for your deck. Yeah, what do you think about Snorlax place in the meta? Like, do you think it's like a tier one deck?
I think it is. And this is maybe a Tina thing. I wasn't actually happy to see, even though I know it's a very favored matchup, because it can still absolutely win if they just hit the right, like, Sydneys, they hit the right Misfortune Sisters, because it has so many tools to do everything it wants to do. I think it definitely is tier one if you play it effectively. Because I think as straightforward as it is, it's still, I think, difficult to play into things that have counters. But most decks, if your matchup's close enough, you probably don't want to play a counter. And if your matchup's really bad, it's not worth it to play a counter anyway. So I think the ones that are in there are just going to kind of slide through.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and it seems like this new iteration is, like, terrifying. It's like, because before, there was a very, like, linear game plan of what they kind of wanted to do. It's like, we're going to deck you out, we're going to do whatever. Now there's, like, Luxray's flying at you, there's a Pidgeot getting whatever they want every turn. It's scary hours, boys. It's scary hours, okay? This Snorlax thing is going to blow up, and we all need to start playing Lost Tina, like, right now.
Yeah. I mean, also, we saw that most of the deck, like, I don't think I saw a single Gardevoir, like, respecting this, like, playing Turo or playing any of that, like, I don't think Mini Aura I saw in, like, any of the top decks, so it's always going to be, like, a game of chicken, like, if people tech for this. But yeah, because, like, the build that Hale played, it only played two Snorlax, so it felt more like a control deck, like, with the Luxray and the Mimikyu, but Kyle played, like, similar. He didn't play the Pidgeot EX, so yeah, it's interesting to see how this is going to keep going forward. In general, people don't like playing stall, so, like, stall decks will never have, like, a huge representation in the meta, but I think Snorlax is going to hover in that, like, 5% to like maybe 7% range, like, going forward. So it's definitely something you have to be, like, cognizant of if you're going to go to a regional.
Yeah.
Cool.
100%.
All right. So I think that's a pretty good recap of San Antonio. So, one thing I wanted to ask, for you, Dan, is you mentioned earlier, and when I was watching the stream, the caster mentioning this, is you had a lot of success in the online tournaments during COVID. I saw you had, like, a result on Limitless before the online tournaments, but, let's say more like your online play, like, do you think that really helped you become a better player? Like, how do you think it translated to, like, playing in real life?
Yeah, I think it was almost the opposite. I think the things I was learning how to do better kind of started to manifest at that time. Mm. So I get super distracted. I'm kind of all over the place at times. So for me, playing in those online tournaments, I guess the biggest things are, I have a lot of answers to this. I'm going to try to condense it. So number one, my skill set is definitely in playing the game. Like, I'm not a great deck builder. I'm not a great meta caller. Like, if there's one thing I can do is just play the stinking game. So when you put me in an environment where I have, like, clean high tier deck lists to take from people, where I'm aware of what my opponent's deck lists are, I know what their resources are, and I know how to do the matchup, like, I'm going to be successful more above average than I would in, like, a random tournament. So, and also for me, I think the thing I started to realize about that time is kind of what I said earlier. If I pick a deck that just lets me play the game every game, I'd probably figure something out. So right about the time when the Players' Cup start happening, That was halfway through my second season. COVID was my second season playing. And I had started to piece together, like, all right, the deck I should pick is one that's consistent, that does the thing all the time, and has enough power and gives me ways to play around things. And so I played Dragapult for the first Players' Cup and then Pikaram for the third and fourth ones. And both of those decks, it just did the thing almost every time, and it helped me be successful. And that's kind of informed what I play now, which is awesome, Tina. Play the game, like, give me options to do stuff. And I think it's more the mentality that helped me be successful there is what I'm applying now, rather than just, like, me kind of figuring out things at that point, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense for sure. So I guess maybe
that's
like
a really good lesson too.
Yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say, like, if you could like distill like one thing for people, like, let's say there's someone who's only ever played online and they're gonna go to like their first regional, like, what would you say is like the most important thing going from like the online to in person?
Well, that's a great question. I would probably say just take the same mentality you have in an online tournament and take it to real life. Like, nothing changes. It's still the game. You still have 60 cards in your deck, whether they're electronic or physical. Just continue to do what you're doing and then look and see what's different and learn as you go. Because it's still the same game. So if you're playing the game well there, you're probably going to have a pretty good shot to do well in a different environment.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, too, like on your point before, has to do with like knowing your identity as a player. So you know your identity is, if I'm handed a good 60, I can play the game, and I will play the game to my outs, and I'll probably win a lot of games. But like, deck building is kind of like your limiting factor. So there's a lot of people I know, at least right now personally, who are like struggling with the game or just frustrated. Like, you've hit that midpoint of the season where people are like capping out, like they're looking for answers. I think that's an important lesson to double back on. So if you've had like some inconsistent results, you don't really know where you're going, like, go back to who you are, go back to your main identity. If deck building is not your strong suit, be like, hey Bob, can you build me a deck and I'll play it right now? Like, just little things like that. And like, I feel that too. I don't think I'm a great deck builder. I think I'm a way better player than I'm a deck builder. And my best runs have been when people have handed me decks. So I think it's important to like know who you are, know what you're doing. And like, some people can pick up, like Azul can pick up a deck within like a week and learn it to a really high caliber. Not everybody is that person. Like, if I pick up a deck, I need like at least 3 weeks to learn it properly. And you have to like understand who you are and maybe not make like last second changes and all that kind of stuff. So I think what you're saying is actually a great lesson for everybody listening. Like, know who you are, know what you're good at, and know your limiting factors.
Yeah, agreed. Cool. And then Dan, you kind of touched on earlier like your mindset when playing Pokemon. So what have you like kind of like maybe like learned or gained from like your therapy profession? Like, how have you kind of like applied that to Pokemon? And like, maybe is there something you see a lot of players like don't do, or like something like they could be applying that like maybe like, is a crossover with like some of your like therapy techniques?
So I would love to say that. I'm actually going to completely flip it. So I started playing Pokemon to prepare to go be a therapist.
Oh, wow.
So when I was an engineer and I needed to go back to school to get my master's in counseling, all that. So I said, you know what? I'm going to completely change careers. I'm going to do a big change. I need to learn how to build mastery and teach myself skills. So the easiest way for me to like pick up something is do something fun that I enjoy when I'm struggling or like don't want to be motivated. I said, you know what? I'm going to learn how to be good at the Pokemon trading card game. I was terrible when I started. I'm like, all right, I'm going to figure out how to learn a skill. So I learned how to like do intentional like testing, learn how to dedicate time, learn how to find resources, learn how to like consistently look for good feedback, where to practice, how to be able to take constructive feedback, all of that. And so I've kind of tried to implement all of those skills used to build a skill here into life and then apply that into therapy. So I'm that guy when I'm meeting with my boss or supervision, I'm always asking questions like, hey, what am I doing well? What can I do differently? What do you think about the situation? What's the right mentality here? On and on from there. So I think for me, and I mentioned this in my stream interview too, just I always want to be intentional about understanding what I can do better and what I can do differently. And I think having that humility to ask questions and not think or need to present that I know something, and feel free to say, I don't know anything. Please teach me. Tell me what I can do differently. How can I do this better? Because I think that'll help accelerate growth and like the ability to succeed by magnitudes.
Yeah,
That's so interesting. That's crazy. Like, that is something only somebody from a background of like psychotherapy or some sort of psychology could think about and actually formulate properly. And like, I guess this is a great testament to like the whole idea of like transferable skills.
Yep.
So like, I've spoken on this podcast many times. I know a lot of people have taken skills from other places, like whether it's discipline from school or like you learn sports psychology. That's kind of how I did it. I learned sports psychology, learn how to lose, how to win, and you transfer it to Pokemon. So it's really interesting to see that like you had another aspect of your life you wanted to get better at, and you chose Pokemon to develop those skills to kind of like transfer to something else. So I find that really, really interesting.
Yeah. I feel like I kind of like, no, I'm not in, like, psychotherapy, but, like, I do, like, programming is, like, my main profession. Like, I feel like my Pokemon skills, like, transfer, like, super well to that. Because it's, like, almost, like, it's problem solving. You're figuring out how to, like, solve these complex problems, like, use logic, all this. And I found a lot of, like, what I learned in Pokemon, like the sequencing, like, how do I, like, map things out. Like, it's very similar to, like, how I approach programming. So, yeah, it's really cool to, like, hear how, like, different people kind of, like, use Pokemon to, like, help not just improve, like, their lives in general. Like, they enjoy it, obviously, but how they can, like, apply that to, like, other professions, like... That's really cool to hear your
perspective. That's such a funny thought to me right now. It's like, if I draw a VIP pass, play a VIP pass, I'll scoop and go to game two.
Yeah, that's what I got.
So interesting how like everyone's profession is so different. They're like, yeah, Pokemon helped me. Yeah, Pokemon.
Pokemon's the best.
So what do you guys think, just to wrap her up here, we've been on for a bit, but just what do you guys think? We can start with Kieran because we've been starting with Dan for everything. He's our guest. Actually, we should start with Dan.
Let's start with Dan.
How do you think, and I don't know how much time you've had to really reflect on the weekend. I know it's all kind of been a blur, and right now it's Monday night when this is being recorded. So haven't had a whole lot of time to reflect, but where do you think the meta is heading? Do you think it's going to change a little bit? Do you think it's mostly going to stay the same? I know it was very diverse. Is there anything that you think really is going to stand out in Portland?
I'm going to add this caveat of all of my skills, metacalling is by far the worst. So whatever I say, please ignore me or go the exact opposite direction. My guess would be Gardy probably sees an uptick in play because Zard was so big. And aside from that, I don't really know how much it's going to shift. To be honest, like you said, it's such a wide meta right now that I think a big shift in day two or top eight, I think it's just going to be more a symptom of randomness than it will be any dynamic like shift in how people are strategizing or approaching the game, since you can take any deck that's like a high tier deck and either do very well or hit a bunch of terrible matchups and not do well. So I don't know how much it's going to change.
Yeah, I think I agree there. Like, I think the meta is pretty like well defined now, where there's like so many decks that it's kind of hard for one deck to just jump a lot. I think some of the fringe decks like that were like lower in the meta share are going to like see slight increases. Like, I think Rapid Strike will go up a couple percentage points. I think Mew will keep going up a couple percentage points. I think Gardevoir will go up a couple percentage points. Snorlax, a couple points. I think Charizard and Rhydon like might come down a couple points just to like compensate for that. But yeah, I think the meta is going to be the same as it's been in the past like three or four tournaments we've had in this format. Like, I just think everyone has the deck they like, and then they'll just keep playing it, iterating on it. I don't think we'll see a lot of people like switching it up.
Buckle up, baby. It's another 4 months of this stuff.
Yeah.
Let's go. They meta for 6 months. Let's go, man.
Yeah, but at least it's diverse this time, not just Lugia stomps everything.
Yeah, exactly. And Gardy does get a bit better after this new like random holiday set. If they reprint that, like,
oh,
they
print
that stadium.
Yeah.
So that's like, at least we get like a little bit of a shake-up. Last year we literally got nothing. It was just like
we got Zamazenta, Lugia went from, bro. Like,
yeah, we got Zamazenta. Lugia went from playing like Evil Tall to playing Raikou. Like, oh, sick meta shakeup, guys. It's unreal. But above all, man, Dan, thanks for coming on. That was an awesome episode. Really nice to have you on. Congratulations on your run. That's a big step for you, one of many, I'm sure. I expect to see you win Worlds this summer, but setting the bar reasonable right now, but we'll see.
We'll see about that, but appreciate it.
Is there anybody you wanted to shout out? Shout out your socials, anything you work on? I know you're an up and coming kind of content creator as well, so feel free to plug yourself here.
Yeah. So first of all, my wife probably won't listen to this, though. I love her. I try not to put her through too much Pokemon stuff, but her, because she was home all weekend handling everything, like taking care of the dog, taking about care of life. Like, she's the reason I can even travel and do this stuff. So she's amazing. Very grateful to have her. Love her very much. Shout out definitely Nerd Rage Gaming. I can't say I'm in content creation per se, but we've been doing a stream and I absolutely love it. It's so much fun to like do the commentary, have some great players in there. And we had 75 masters last time. Norm, the owner, is probably going to try to get us a different venue so we can get over 100 people for the next cup. And it's a 1K, like, it's a blast. So shout out them. And then shout out Kevin Krieger, Limitless Online Series champion, who's been a huge, huge asset in growing in my game. Ryan, Ben, just all the guys from Nerd Rage and local guys. It's been such a cool community to build. Very, very lucky to be a part of it.
Awesome, man.
Oh,
awesome.
And also Twitter. I'm at DanTheTrainer25. I post there sometimes.
Nice. All right, so everyone go follow Dan. If you need a Pokemon therapist, if you want to like gripe about not drawing VIP pass, this is your man. So go hit him up.
You're setting him up for the most obscene like 2 weeks of his life, man. He's going to hate this thing after he's done. Everyone's like DMing me him like, man, I'm sad. I didn't get VIP pass.
No, but honestly, I think about that. I think there's a lot of people who like, I don't have like maybe like a relationship with the game that's a bit toxic. Like they depend on it too much. Like their results like determine their self-worth. So I think it would actually be like really interesting. And Dan could be like really valuable because he has such a unique perspective on this. So yeah, it'd be cool if Dan can specialize in, or not specialize, but have some unique perspective for Pokemon clients.
Well, legit. Also, if anyone is struggling and it is Pokemon or non-Pokemon related, like feel free to ping me, DM me, whatever. Like, I'm always happy to talk to and meet new people. So, sure.
Sweet.
Awesome. I use Dan to talk me out about deck decisions sometimes. So, that's honestly, like, had I not known you were a psychotherapist, I'd just think you're a genius. It's just a genius.
Just keep that mentality. Roll with it, Anil. That's great.
Yeah. Just a genius, man. Anyways, man, thanks for coming on. Best of luck to you in the future. We'll be in touch. I'm sure we'll have you back on at some point. What's your next regionals?
I'm currently going to Portland and then Charlotte and then maybe Knoxville. I did not think I was gonna be doing this well, so I thought I'd have to go to a lot more events, so I'm just currently still going to them.
Nice.
Yeah, might as well get it done sooner rather than later, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Hawaii's expensive. You want to book that thing like ASAP, man.
Yep.
Yes, it is.
I was looking today, guys. I'm scared. It's expensive, man.
Oh, boy.
It's worse than Japan.
Is it?
Yeah.
The hotels are worse, I think. But yeah, it's like crazy.
Yeah, so it's going to be an expensive summer.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Well, we'll deal with that. We'll cross that bridge when we get there, yeah? For everybody who's listening, thank you so much for coming back for another week. It was an awesome weekend in San Antonio. We saw a lot of history being made. Saw one Dan the Trainer get to top 8, which was honestly all the history I needed to watch. But saw a lot of stuff. Format's evolving. We're having fun. We'll see you guys next week. Take care.
Take it easy.
Peace.